Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Jurnov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you want to download it to your computer, your iPod, disk, whatever you listen to things on. Today we have an excellent show as we celebrate a milestone, which we actually helped to facilitate here in Pittsburgh at a recent Friends of eDiscovery meeting. Judge Conte, who's on the show, was the 100th judge in the country to sign the Sedona Conference's Cooperation Proclamation. This historic eDiscovery movement has seen solid growth over the course of the last year. We talked to Richard Brayman last year about the launch of the Cooperation Proclamation, so we thought this would be a good opportunity to revisit at this historic occasion. So let me introduce the panelists. We have Judge Conte on, of course, who's a federal district judge from the Western District of Pennsylvania. Prior to her appointment, she was a shareholder with the Pittsburgh office of Buchanan Ingersoll, now Buchanan Ingersoll Rooney. And prior to joining Buchanan, she was a partner with Kirkpatrick Lockhart, which is now K&L Gates. Judge Conte was a professor of law at Duquesne University, taught courses on civil procedure, corporations, corporate finance, corporate reorganizations, and bankruptcy. She's co-authored two articles dealing with e-discovery and has lectured at seminars on e-discovery. Judge Conte is also the former president of the Allegheny County Bar Association in 1993. He's listed in Who's Who in America and Who's Who in American Law, and while practicing law was listed in the Best Lawyers in America. She's a member of the prestigious American Law Institute and the American College of Bankruptcy. She also was governor-at-large of the Pennsylvania Bar Association, was the chair of the PBA's business law section, and received the PBA's 1995 Ann X. Alpern Award, which annually recognizes one outstanding woman lawyer. She was also the president of the Third Circuit Historical Society. Judge, thank you for joining us on this this important podcast.
I'm happy to be here.
Great. And, of course, I mentioned we have Richard Brayman, who's the founder and executive director of the Sedona Conference. As a practicing attorney, he has represented both plaintiffs and defendants in antitrust, IP, and other complex business litigations since 1978. Prior to founding the Sedona Conference, Richard was co-chair of the antitrust practice group of the Minneapolis law firm of Gray Plant Moody. Before joining Gray Plant Moody, Richard also owned and operated a nationally renowned jazz club and practiced in plaintiff's antitrust class action law firm in Minneapolis and with a large defense-oriented firm in San Francisco. So Richard's one of the thought leaders behind the Cooperation Proclamation, and Richard, we're glad to have you on the show.
Thanks, Carl. Great to be back.
And with less than 24 hours notice while drafting questions, I thought, my, it'd be nice to have a practicing lawyer on the show. So after scouring the country, we came up with one volunteer, Therese Miller, who's of counsel with Shook, Hardy & Bacon in their San Francisco, California office, and she's part of their eDiscovery practice group. She was a technology and systems analyst by training before she became an attorney. She advises clients on electronic data management and information law relative to electronic discovery, data security and privacy rights, records management, and legal technology. She's also been doing a good deal of speaking on Web 2.0 technologies and cloud computing. She's also a member of the Sedona Conference, and she's representing all practicing lawyers on this podcast. So good luck, Therese. All right, well, let's jump right in. First of all, Richard, if you could provide a brief overview of the Cooperation Proclamation and where you can find it, and also, does being a listener of jazz help with creating a cooperation vibe?
Oh, it's good to improvise. thanks, Carl. The genesis of the Cooperation Proclamation started with a panel I was on in March of 2007 at Georgetown. It was called the Data Deluge Summit, and it included Justice Breyer and a bunch of people smarter than I, and we were talking about the problems that the volume of ESI was creating for e-discovery and costs and getting cases to trial. And at one point I made the comment that, you know, if opposing counsel would cooperate more in the fact-finding process and save their adversarial skills for litigating the meaning of those facts or the application of the facts to the law, that discovery would be more affordable. And in the spirit of dialogue, the moderator indicated that he thought that was a utopian idea and we'd revisit it later. And it was a great conference, but about a year later, I was still stewing about the utopian comment. So I decided it was time to put a stake in the ground, basically, and write something called the Sedona Conference Cooperation Proclamation. It was originally titled the Collaboration Manifesto, but no one liked my irony, and too many World War II veterans thought collaboration was the wrong word to use, so it came out Cooperation Proclamation. But the concept is really very simple. As we say in the second paragraph, with this proclamation, the Sedona Conference launches a national drive to promote open and forthright information sharing, dialogue, both internal and external, training, and the development of practical tools to facilitate cooperative, collaborative, transparent discovery. This proclamation challenges the bar to achieve these goals and refocus litigation toward the substantive resolution of legal disputes. And it's a short proclamation, meant to be short like proclamations are, it's 3 pages. But the very first thing we address is how cooperation and discovery is consistent with zealous advocacy. I just want to read one paragraph from that. Lawyers have twin duties of loyalty. While they are retained to be zealous advocates for their clients, they bear a professional obligation to conduct discovery in a diligent and candid manner. Their combined duty is to strive in the best interest of their clients to achieve the best results at a reasonable cost with integrity and candor as officers of the court. Cooperation does not conflict with the advancement of their clients' interests. It enhances it. Only when lawyers confuse advocacy with adversarial conduct are these twin duties in conflict. And in the conclusion, we say that using this springboard, the legal profession can engage in a comprehensive effort to promote pretrial discovery cooperation. Our officer of the court duties demand no less. This project is not utopian. Rather, it is a tailored effort to effectuate the mandate of court rules calling for a just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of every action and the fundamental ethical principles governing our profession. The proclamation itself envisions a 3-stage process. We finished 2 stages and we're entering the 3rd stage, symbolized by the acronym ACT. The first part is awareness, and that was the proclamation itself, putting our stake in the ground in terms of the need for cooperation. The second part is the C is for commitment. That's developing a detailed understanding and full articulation of the issues and changes needed to obtain cooperative fact-finding. This will take the form of a case for cooperation, basically a Brandeis brief explaining why the rules mandate expect cooperation, why your professional duties as an officer of the court mandate expect cooperation, and actually how cooperation can serve the strategic best interests of your client, let alone the economic best interests of your client. We published a supplement to Volume 10 of the Sedona Conference Journal in November of last year, November 2009. It's available on the homepage of our website. And the case for cooperation is contained in that supplement, along with an article by Professor Gensler called The Cooperation Bullseye, which makes the point even stronger in terms of the strategic advantages to cooperation. And then there's a 3rd article that summarizes the 12 decisions, I think, at that point that had cited the Cooperation Proclamation that we were aware of. How does the listener of jazz help with creating a cooperation vibe? I've heard stories from lawyers in the field that when they are in a cooperative mode, adversarial lawyers, opposing counsel, and trying to cooperate in terms of e-discovery and discovery plans in general, that the more they think out of the box, they can come up with creative, cost-saving, effective solutions to achieve the goal of Rule 1. If they approach their Rule 26F discussions and other discussions about a discovery plan with a clean slate and with an idea of just getting the facts on the table so the case can progress to trial, they'll come up with solutions that aren't on everybody's checklist of the way you do things. So just like jazz is improvisational in nature, to the extent we can bring a little improvisational thinking to our legal practices, it's going to help in cooperation.
Yeah, thinking's always a good thing. I got to add, Richard, I was at that Georgetown presentation that you gave, and not only was the utopia comment made, I mentioned a question about, well, does this apply with small firms, and everyone snickered. was it just the utopia? And that turned into a presentation I did with Judge Facciola, which ultimately turned into ESI Bytes. So that was quite a presentation.
Interesting.
Anyway.
One of the funny things about that, the Gartner Corporation did a report on the that conference in March of 07, and they mentioned the utopian comment, but one of the four takeaways on the first page of their report is cooperation is key to discovery.
Great. Well, Judge Conte, what are your views on cooperation, electronic discovery, and why did you design the Cooperation Proclamation? I mean, obviously, you didn't know there were 99 in the can, and you were going to be number 100. So,
well, having come onto the bench approximately 7.5 years ago, that was just the beginning of when we were starting to see issues about electronic discovery. And over the course of the last several years, I had an occasion on a number of lawsuits that are filed here to observe what happens when there is not cooperation early on in a case. And the consequences were that there was very extensive litigation on a side issue that was distracting from getting to the merits of the case. It was the type of situation where there had to be significant judicial oversight, hearings, opinions, perhaps appointments of special masters. So it was inefficient from the judicial point of view. It was expensive for the litigation, and it really wasn't getting to what justice is all about, and that's resolving the merits. As a result of my role on our local Rules Committee, which I chair, I had an occasion to spearhead the review of all of our local rules. And in that process, our local rules advisory committee, which consists of over 20 lawyers, put together a group of lawyers specifically to look at what we should be doing here in the Western District with respect to e-discovery. And I'm happy to say a few of those lawyers who were spearheading that project for us are participants in the Sedona Conference. And so a lot of the issues and thoughts that came out of the Sedona Conference, including this cooperation proclamation, were at the forefront of what we were considering doing here. So we did come up with new local rules to help lawyers in an early stage to be advised about what their obligations are, that they need to investigate, that they have to be forthright with each other in terms of what they've done to preserve electronic discovery, how it can be produced. They are directed, if it's an appropriate case, that to get a resource person available to them that can interface with the other side's resource person to try to get through the e-discovery in as cost-effective, efficient manner as possible. And also, there's a lot of pushback from clients because of the cost and expense involved. And I remind counsel frequently that when they come to the scheduling conference, the first scheduling conference, that they need to have talked about these issues, because if cost is a problem, there is the concept of proportionality within the civil rules. And proportionality means that if the cost of the discovery is disproportionate to the underlying case in terms of the merits and what's at stake, you know, the court has to weigh that and take that into consideration in coming to fashion what would be any appropriate limitations that may be necessary for the discovery. And the court can't perform that function unless the lawyers have really talked about it in advance, educated each other in terms of what the respective clients have in the way of e-documents, how they're stored, how they can be produced, how they can be reviewed in terms of the types of protocols they may come up with. So it's incumbent on the lawyers to have cooperated with each other, even though they may be in disagreement about how the court should rule. But there has to be a level of knowledge on both sides before they come to the court if there's a dispute. Most cases, the lawyers will agree as to what the limitations should be, because it's sort of a mutual situation. If you've got large entities on both sides, they have a mutual interest in paring down the discovery to frame it in a way that can get to the merits without undue cost. And if there's one side that's has much more resources than the other, you know, you may have some tension there, but lawyers, for the most part, understand these issues and hopefully can work through them. But it's not going to happen unless they cooperate early on. And when I was approached to consider signing the Sedona Conference Cooperation Proclamation, I saw in it many of the things that we were focusing here in the Western District on. And I want to look at specifically the tools that are referred to accomplish the cooperation. And these are the kinds of things that here in the Western District we've tried to focus on. You have to have the one tool is to utilize internal electronically stored discovery point persons, and that's what we would refer to in our court as the resource persons. So we are trying to implement that. We are also looking to an exchange of information on relevant data sources, including those not being searched. And we have this as part of, not as specific as that, but as part of are the obligations that the lawyers have prior to the first scheduling conference. And there are a number of others that are topics that we have considered here. So when I read through this proclamation, I saw it as something that was very relevant in my district. It was relevant in the cases that I was working on, and my view was that whatever I could do as a judge to tell the lawyers in our community that this is important, that we want cooperation here because it's going to be helpful to the litigants, it's going to be helpful to the court, and it's very important that people are aware of it, focused, and committed. And those are all concepts that are embodied in the proclamation. And for that reason, after I read it, I felt that it was an appropriate recognition of the significance of the proclamation for me to sign on to it.
Right. Carol, if I can, I'd like to underscore two excellent points Judge Conte made. First, on the tools, I forgot to get to the third part of our acronym of ACT, and part three is tools. Just saying that cooperation is a good idea isn't going to make it happen. People need to be trained in it. They need to know how to act cooperatively. They need to know where the cooperation opportunities are in the fact-finding process. So part three of this national effort is developing and distributing practical toolkits to train and support lawyers, judges, and other professionals. We are going to be releasing before the end of the year a guidance for litigators, guidance for in-house counsel, and a resource document for the bench, all with the goal of providing the proper toolkits to train lawyers in how to best use cooperation in the fact-finding process. What are your opportunities to cooperate? Judge Conte mentioned a number of them, and not to tell you what the outcome should be, but what your opportunities are to use cooperation. The second one that I think is going to be extremely important over the next couple of years is the proportionality rule that Judge Conte mentioned. Even though that's been on the books for almost two decades, I think, it's rarely cited in opinions. It's rarely briefed to the court when it comes to discovery motions, but it's obviously key to the scope of discovery, key especially in cases that aren't billion-dollar cases. And it's something that could be used as a sword and a shield, so it needs to be thought about carefully. The Sedona Conference is going to be issuing a commentary on proportionality this fall as well. But the point I want to make is you cannot have a meaningful discussion about a proportional discovery plan with opposing counsel unless you are behaving cooperatively in the fact-finding process when you're talking about location of data, data sources, custodians, how data is maintained, the best way to produce it, all of that. And unless you talk about those things, you can never begin a discussion over how you can end up with a proportional discovery plan, which I think is going to be a key playing ground as we go forward. The last thing I want to mention that I'd forgotten earlier is where do you find the Cooperation Proclamation? It's on the homepage of our website, www.thesedonaconference.org. Sorry, thanks.
Okay, no, great. And I want to move in sort of like the practical, how this is playing out. But before I do that, and you've given a few examples of some of the trilogy of approach within the cooperation. But is the last year, is anything that you like to tout showing how it's working that's happened?
Well, in addition to being up to, I think, 17 reported cases that we are aware of that have cited to it, there's two recent events that I think are pretty exciting to us, at least. The Seventh Circuit did a pilot project starting a year ago that, in its introduction, indicates it was inspired by the Cooperation Proclamation and principles of cooperation are sprinkled throughout its pilot program.
I want to mention we're going to do a podcast on that. I've been talking to the judges involved, and it's looking very promising. So anyway, very good stuff.
And they're just beginning the second year of that effort as well. The other thing I wanted to mention is the Civil Rules Advisory Committee on May 10th and 11th sponsored a conference at Duke talking about whether or not rules changes are needed because of excessive costs in litigation and the vanishing civil trial, et cetera. And there was recently issued, I think, May 17th, a report of the Civil Rules Advisory Committee on that conference. Just want to read one paragraph from that report. This is reporting on a two-day conference where there were a number of competing proposals from rules changes ranging from a whole different approach to tweaks to no changes. But here's the paragraph. Cooperation among adversary counsel is a common theme running through many of these observations. The consensus in favor of promoting cooperation is widespread and fervent. Cooperation founded on mutual trust can do more than the rules or judicial management to achieve the purposes of Rule 1. Tales abounded of cases in which cooperation of counsel achieved better results faster and at a lower cost. Several participants urged the need to educate lawyers to understand that cooperation is not only consistent with zealous advocacy, but in fact can enhance the quality of advocacy on all sides. The rules emphasize cooperation at many places. Some modicum of cooperation is in fact essential. Without it, the process would fall apart. Whether more can be done through court rules is uncertain, but attempts to redirect all too common exaggerations and distortions of the duties of professional representation are vigorously supported. Standards of cooperation have been adopted by various professional groups. The need may be more for instruction and adherence than for developing still more articulations of the underlying principle. The other exciting thing to report, of course, is with Judge Connie, we passed 100 on endorsements. We now have, I think, about 103 or 104 endorsements of state and federal judges from over 30 states coast to coast, and we're going to be continuing that drive as long as it takes to get the entire bench on board.
650 away from Barry Bonds or so. Hey, I'm going to speed up to Therese at this point because, you know, we've been talking at a high level here. I want to sort of get into the field. This was the reason I thought to have you on the program. What's your reaction to the Cooperation Proclamation, and has it worked for you yet? I know you're out west. You're more mellow than people on the East Coast, but how have you been seeing cooperation in practice?
Well, and you know, I probably should mention that I just moved out to the West Coast last September, so I don't know that I could represent all of the West Coast.
Well, you're from here in Kansas City, so you're sensible too. You're mellow and sensible. This is great stuff for cooperation. If we could get the jazz in there with Richard, which is great.
My first reaction to the Cooperation Proclamation actually did have the use of the word utopian, which I feel kind of sheepish now after hearing Richard's comments. And not having been a part of the conference at Georgetown in 2007. But the idea that I think an adversarial system can be cooperative is kind of counterintuitive. And I think when you talk to lawyers who are really not involved in e-discovery, and sometimes not even involved in the discovery stage of their cases, they're more in the motion practice phases, you know, their first reaction is against it. But I think, you know, from a perspective of, you know, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, if it works, you know, I think it's always in the best interest of all the parties, and it complements other policy-driven rules like the Amendment to 502 of the Federal Rules of Evidence. And in addition, it's entirely consistent with the requirements of good faith that have been part of the discovery rules from the very beginning. And so the requirement of good faith has always been there, I think that the Cooperation Proclamation just reinforces what you would normally consider your obligation as an attorney.
And
I add one comment to that? And it's a real-world comment. It comes from a case out of Iowa 2 weeks ago. This is Magistrate Judge Bremer. She talks about the painful process of discovery in this case demonstrates the need for counsel to cooperate. It is the clients who suffer when the meet and confer requirements are bypassed, when hundreds of pages of motions are filed to resolve what could be addressed in a single phone call, when the federal rules of civil procedure are used as a sword rather than a mechanism to ensure the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of the action. Stop the madness. Use cooperation and proportionality to save the clients both time and money. Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 26G requires counsel to certify that discovery answers or objections are complete and correct based upon information and belief formed after a reasonable inquiry. It is in the client's best interest and absolutely necessary to avoid excessive or abusive discovery for counsel to cooperate. It is not unrealistic for the court to expect, quote, cooperative, collaborative, transparent discovery, close quote, citing to the Cooperation Proclamation.
Judge Connie, I want to get your perspective from the Western District of Pennsylvania regarding cooperation. And actually, part of the reason I'm asking this is I was at a presentation that you gave about 2 to 3 months ago for the Federal Bar on eDiscover, a CLE program, and you were talking about cooperation at a certain point in time. And literally, someone in the back row began humming Kumbaya. So it wasn't utopia. It was a different reaction. Although, you know, in Pittsburgh, we have a very rich history in cooperation. I wanted you to talk a little bit about what you're seeing in Western Pennsylvania. Are lots of people singing Kumbaya when this is coming up, or are you beginning to see cooperation?
There is a modicum of cooperation. The lawyers all basically know about our new local rules, which require a fairly detailed investigation, requires forthright conversations between the counsel. But in a lot of instances, it's honored in the breach because lawyers are busy and they're rushing around, and when they get to the meet and confer, it's often either by telephone or perhaps by email exchanges. And so that's a sad commentary in some ways, that the meet and confers are really not seen as an opportunity to cooperate and put this discovery in a framework that it can be efficient and cost effective. But we're making progress on that. The lawyers are aware of it. The recent decision by Judge Shinlin out of the Southern District of New York in the pension fund case shows that this e-discovery is a moving target in terms of the standards that are applicable. And by moving target, I mean that what were the standards that lawyers would adhere to 5 years ago are not the same standards today. It's evolving. It's an evolving standard for what lawyers must do. And it's important that the clients be educated, because I think some of the pushback is from the clients as opposed to the lawyers. But the more education we have for the bar, for the clients who come into the litigation, the better off we're going to be. But it's evolving. We are making progress. It's somewhat slow, but I'm encouraged. And I think as time goes on, it will become part of the fabric of how law is practiced here.
Judge Conte, on your evolving concept, not only are the principles evolving, technology is obviously moving very fast in this area, and what it means to be a competent lawyer is evolving as well.
Yes, I agree with all of that.
Unless lawyers are familiar enough to at least know what questions to ask their IT people, they can't competently represent their clients in a Rule 26F conference consistent with the purpose of Rule 26F. So one of the things that needs to continue to happen, of course, is basic training for lawyers to get them competent in e-discovery fundamentals, because you can't cooperate with the other side without having some modicum of trust. And if you don't know the subject matter, it's very hard to trust the other side. You'll always think they're trying to pull the wool over your eyes.
Well, Therese, I'm not sure if Richard stole some of the thunder from what might be your answer, but if you get into this meet and confer situation and hearing Judge Conte say it's been, you know, slow progress, what's slowing it down? I mean, you don't have a judge present at this initial meeting. You might have people not familiar with cooperation. You know, where are the issues happening?
Well, and you know, a lot of the comments that Richard mentioned and Judge Conte mentioned would, you know, implicate in my answer. Judge Conte's comment that clients are driving a lot of the opposition, I completely agree with. A lot of the comments, you know, that I hear from clients it is a little bit opposed to the idea of cooperation, mostly because usually, at least with my clients who are large corporations, you know, they're the ones with the more resources. They're not on the equal footing with the other side. And so, you know, I think the biggest issue with, you know, entering a meet and confer is that both parties are not in equal positions, and so they feel kind of slighted. And you end up with, you know, a lot of this, what we call discovery about discovery or meta-discovery, and where you have discovery going into the other party's preservation and collection efforts and not going to the merits of the cases like Judge Conte mentioned earlier. And so I think, you know, the equal footing is an issue. I think also sometimes you end up in a situation where the competency of the lawyers is implicated, like Richard said, where, you know, maybe one side is educated on e-discovery and electronically stored information, but then the other side is either pretending to be or is just not there. And so you end up with a situation, and even speaking from personal experience, you know, and this is pre-cooperation proclamation, but, you know, I was involved in a major trademark infringement case, and we had, you know, attempted to meet and confer with the other side because there was an issue happening with a trademark infringement situation on a Google AdWord. And we couldn't get the lawyers on the other side to understand what we were talking about technologically. And so, you know, when the motion came up in discovery, their response to the motion was clear that they didn't understand the technological problem that we were alleging. But then when you're on the other side and you're representing a client zealously, you know, pick up the phone and say, talk to your IT person and figure out the problem, admit that you made a mistake, or do you have to go into this, you know, hundreds of pages of motion practice, like Richard mentioned, how do you stop the madness?
You know, I was thinking the first part of your answer and one of the answers Judge Conte gave, and it's a question I was going to ask near the end, but Richard, any thoughts on amending the cooperation proclamation to include maybe the participants on the same side of an e-discovery project?
So the second paragraph I read at the very outset talks about dialogue internal and external. And at all of our Getting Ahead of the eDiscovery Curve programs, we've had panels and papers on new roles and new teams in the digital age. And it's extremely important to have a team approach to eDiscovery on each side, so that IT is talking to general counsel, is talking to the business unit, is talking to outside counsel, is talking to the vendor if a vendor is involved, to make sure you're doing what you need to do and that everybody knows who's on first.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking this is I know people are talking because they're having meetings, but you know, the most amazing thing happened at a meeting that I had about 6-8 weeks ago with Judge Conte was present, where I asked a group of lawyers, half in-house, half outside, at the collection phase and the preservation phase, how many in-house feel that when the outside counsel is coming to them with this request, you got to do this, you got to do that, like they got to hold on to their wallets, basically, you know, that they're trying to make some money. And everyone raised their hand. And then I asked the same question to outside counsel. How many feel like you've been in situations where you're being stonewalled, you're not getting the, quote, cooperation? Unanimous raising hands. Now, it's not every situation, but they've all encountered it.
Well, there's a huge cultural issue that you're
running into
there.
The 800-pound gorilla in the room.
Well, there's a traditional law firm profit model that is being challenged by what's going on today. There is the drive from the in-house counsel perspective, or the in-house perspective, to bring more of the effort in-house to save money. There is the ultimate responsibility issue of who's doing the 26G certification and what that means. But none of that affects the fact who's ever doing something. In terms of the producing party, and in many lawsuits, both sides are producing parties at the same level, they do have to take a team approach, and they have to find out the most efficient, effective way to do things, and the only way to do that is to sit down and work it out together, not to have one person telling everybody else what to do, because the collective wisdom will always produce a better result. So the brief answer to your question is we've been training on that issue for 4 years and are going to continue to do so. Where that's going to end up in terms of whether the traditional model obtains, whether it's done more in-house instead of by outside counsel, whether it's done outsourcing, whether it's some combination of all of the above, only the marketplace can answer that question.
Okay. Now, Judge Conte, as a judge involved in this process, how can you aid in facilitating cooperation between parties? And is the cooperation battle lost once you've been gotten involved?
It's not entirely lost once I've gotten involved. I think sometimes the client has to know that the judge is requiring certain things to happen, and that can be an aid to the lawyers to really energize the cooperation. So I think it's not entirely lost. It does become lost if the judicial intervention is late in the game, meaning where there has been deletion or an inability to access certain documents because of a failure to preserve. That's when it becomes really problematic for the parties. And the court, that's one of the reasons we like the Sedona Conference Cooperation Proclamation, because it's calling for action early to avoid those types of situations. And also, I just want to give some kudos to the Sedona Conference Cooperation Proclamation, because when I read through this, one of the tools that they mentioned that is mentioned is considering court-appointed experts, volunteer mediators, or formal ADR programs to resolve discovery disputes. And when I read that, I thought, this could be something that would be of benefit here in the Western District. And I approached our ADR committee for the court and asked if this was something that they would be interested in considering. And they are interested, and they are putting together a panel of individuals who could be qualified to provide ADR services in the e-discovery area, as well as serving as special masters.
Richard, do you see a movement in that direction where you're getting more facilitated cooperation?
Actually, in January of this year, we put on our first e-discovery dispute resolution program for special masters and mediators, and it was a resounding success, and we plan on continuing those programs at least on an annual basis, because there's a need at the special master level, there's a need at the mediation level, there's a need for volunteer mediators to the extent they can be adjuncts to the court. For the smaller cases, they can't afford special master fees. Because a lot of times in smaller cases, the lawyers don't have the time or the money to do what is necessary to be done and to mediate the dispute with the help of someone with a little more skill and knowledge in the area would actually get the merits resolved quicker and cheaper than otherwise would happen.
And Therese, I was just thinking, we've raised two obstacles here. Sometimes the client doesn't understand, and sometimes the adversary just isn't very well-schooled or educated in e-discovery. How do you work in those situations to educate or facilitate cooperation, you know, as sort of a, you know, the representation of practicing lawyers?
Well, and, you know, and to go back to what Richard just mentioned, we actually do encourage the appointing of a neutral party in e-discovery disputes so that we can manage the non-education of the other side. Or we ask for an expert witness to testify in our case or provide an affidavit about what the discovery is and how the production has complied with the discovery obligations of the parties. So I think that's one way. Another way is, you know, just to approach the meet and confer with an open attitude, and you know, instead of coming to the meet and confer with the idea of setting up the other side for a spoliation motion, what you do is you come in and you are frank with the other side, you know, take the local rules of your jurisdiction, hopefully that consider e-discovery rules, but if not, then, you know, discuss the actual systems of the parties and how you're going to approach the e-discovery situation and try your best to educate the other side.
You know, one of the things that's come out of previous podcasts, one of my favorite moments on ESI Bites was a program I did with Bill Butterfield, where he was talking about an example of putting a privilege log together with a well-trained e-discovery lawyer on the other side, and they agreed on metadata for presumptive privilege. No reason to put a log together, hundreds of thousands of dollars of easily grasped savings. And what Bill has said to me on the side was the key to that happening was they both knew each other's background. They were, you know, they knew they were both well-educated in this area, and they knew it made sense. They were thinking.
And it's really in the client's best interest for lawyers to think like that. I can't imagine a client who wants to spend the money on putting together something they don't need to put together.
Yeah, but I mean, that's one of the challenges we all face. That's one of the reasons I do ESI Bites, is to try to get more education out there in the hands of more people. But you know, the truth of the matter is, even within firms, my experience from doing this show and talking to firms is you'll have pockets of understanding.
Therese, can I ask you a question from the practical side?
Sure.
We talked about how clients are a big driver for reducing costs and sometimes push back on cooperation because they view it as capitulation, which it's not. Do you see firms like yours with a client base like you have starting to talk to your clients about moving to flat fee approaches, even on the defense side, which, in my opinion, sort of naturally leads to a more cooperative attitude in fact-finding to spend less money in that process?
Absolutely. A lot of the clients are pushing for that from the client perspective to go into the flat fee arrangements or alternative billing arrangements. Largely driven by the ACC Value Project and other initiatives that kind of take a look at proportionality issues and trying to reduce costs in e-discovery. But usually, bringing e-discovery in-house is one thing that a lot of the clients are looking at least to consider. And then also, trying to streamline their technology from an e-discovery perspective. And I think, the idea of cost savings also drives a little bit of the cooperation. I mean, I think, the idea is to open a dialogue so that everyone has an honest desire to find alternatives that are mutually satisfactory, whether it's with the other side or, internally with your processes.
If you end up bringing the fact-finding or the collection, identification, and production of information in-house, how do you handle the 26G certification? Because when in the olden days when I was a practicing lawyer, the lawyers went and met with the custodians and actually looked through their files to find the responsive information and could easily sign a 26G certification comfortable. They'd done a good faith due diligence effort to find responsive information that wasn't privileged. If in-house counsel is doing it all, how does outside counsel satisfy their obligations under 26G?
I mean, I think it's developing a dialogue with the clients, despite the fact that in-house counsel are conducting all of the steps themselves. But we have had clients grappling with that exact fact, and how do you approach the 26G certification? And I think it's just really, having a good documentation of what is happening in your preservation and collection efforts. And if you, are able to understand what's happening, then you can certify to it.
Interesting. Thank you.
Yeah. No, that is very interesting. Well, I think the common theme that's coming out of here is be thinking through the process. You know, keep your thinking caps on, and you know, try to work through areas that make sense with the other side. So, I'd like to thank you all for appearing on this show. I think it's been helpful. We're going to have a follow-up show with a number of practicing lawyers around the country and in sort of middle markets off the beaten path, talking about cooperation, see if it's gathering hold there outside of the Sedona world. And but Richard, Therese, thanks for joining us on another show, and it's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners. And Judge Conte, thank you for joining us for the first time and being the 100th lawyer to sign the Cooperation Proclamation, and hopefully we'll be able to do more shows with you later this year. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibites.com, that's with a Y, for a complete list of our shows. You can also remember our show and website phonetically, as it sounds like easy bites of information if you sound it out. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bites to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shineman, Director of Legal Analytics and Jurnov Review from Jurnov, wishing you a nice day.